we're going to be doing today. Today we are, time permitting, going to be looking at two separate midrashim from Vayikra that happen one after the other. And the question that I want us to have in the back of our minds as we read these midrashim is, what emotional and pastoral need does each of these interpretations play to? Again, what emotional or pastoral need, you might say spiritual need, does each of these midrashim play to? And I'll explain a little bit about what I mean by that question. There is a theory about Vayikra Rabbah in general that many of the midrashim that we see in Vayikra Rabbah were originally given actually as sermons, possibly in Shul, possibly in other locations, and that one of their primary purposes was to take the, as we've discussed, often rather esoteric portions of Vayikra and make them immediately spiritually and emotionally meaningful to the people listening to them. What we'll be focusing on today is two midrashim that focus on the verse that says, you shall not practice as the Egyptians practiced. Don't do the actions of the Egyptians that you were exiled among. And what these midrashim will be doing is talking a little bit about what actually was the reality of the Jewish people in Egypt, and more specifically, why did God redeem the Jewish people from Egypt? Let's take a moment just to play with that question a little bit. Why did God redeem the Jewish people from Egypt? People can use the chat to answer. Because we cried out to God. Okay, great, close reading. So in the actual chat, God sees the Jewish people crying out, and that's when God jumps in to fulfill his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Again, good reading, part of what God says to Moshe, because God wanted a people. So Arlene, you're going to see that you are actually intuiting a little bit into the second midrash that we're going to see. Ellen Rothberg, I don't like this, but for the greatness of God's name. So it seems maybe tied to the fulfill the promise part. Sharon Perlman says, so God could make a covenant with us at Sinai. This is fascinating because what's actually happening here is people are in little pieces picking up on a lot of the intuitions of the actual midrash around this. So let's jump in and see what that looks like inside. I'm going to read in the English, and we'll stop every so often to make sure that we all understand what's going on. You shall not copy the practices of the land of Egypt. So this is the verse from our parsha, as it says, like a rose among the thorns. So this is a common practice of Vayikra Rabbah that we've encountered before. We have a verse from our parsha, and then immediately following, we say that we're going to link it to a verse from one of the Nevi'im, or more often one of the Ketuvim. So here we're being linked to a verse from Shir HaShirim, from the Song of Songs. And in the comments, Kishona ben Hachochim, Ken Rayati ben Habanot, the full verse is like a rose among the thorns, so is my beloved one among women. And we're going to see how the rabbis link those two verses up. We'll keep going. Rabbi Elazar interpreted the verse as referring to the redemption from Egypt. So Rabbi Elazar is saying that verse, like a rose among the thorns, is actually a reference back to redemption from Egypt. Just as a rose, when it is among the thorns, is difficult to pick, so too the redemption of the Jewish people was difficult for God to accomplish. So a rose, when it's surrounded by thorns, if you want to pick it, it's very hard to do it without hurting yourself. We're actually saying that by linking this pasuk to the redemption from Egypt, what it teaches us is that it was actually very difficult for God to redeem the Jewish people, which isn't something we usually think about. We usually think that God can do anything. We don't usually think things are difficult for God. But this midrash is saying actually it was very difficult for the following reason. As it says, Or has any God ventured to take for himself one nation from the midst of another? That verse is being used here to say, yeah, what does it mean, that verse in Dvarim, that God has never, that no other God has taken a people from among other peoples to redeem them? That actually is saying it's a very hard thing to do. It wasn't easy what God did for you, for the following reason. These and those were both uncircumcised. These and those grew their hair in a blurred fashion. This is a stereotypically, in the Midrash and Gemara, non-Jewish fashion that seems to be some sort of braiding, possibly. These and those wore kilayim, meaning halachically forbidden mixtures of different fabrics. And all of these are meant to point to, actually, the Jewish people were indistinguishable from the Egyptians in most ways. They were essentially entirely assimilated. And in this interpretation, it's not just that if you go to pick the rose among the thorns, it's difficult because you might get hurt. It's also, it's difficult to see the rose among the thorns. It becomes hidden. According to the attribute of strict justice, the Jewish people should not have been redeemed from Egypt. So if everything was as it should have been, if the world was a just place, in this reading, the Jewish people shouldn't have been redeemed at all. I want us to take a moment. We're going to discuss this more when we get to the end of this first midrash, to just think about, at this moment, what's your emotional reaction to what the midrash is saying? Is it in any way comforting, or is it actually off-putting? Is it alienating? And if it's alienating, let's just keep track of that and see what happens to that feeling as the midrash goes on. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani said, if it were not for the fact that God had imprisoned himself through a vow, the Jewish people would never have been redeemed. So people who said that God redeemed the Jewish people because God made a promise to Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, exactly what the Midrash is intuiting. As it says, say therefore to the Israelite people, I am the Lord. So when God appears to Moshe, this is in Shmot Perek Vav, I believe. He actually says to Moshe, say, there, the Midrash is focusing in on the word therefore. Say therefore to the Israelite people, I am the Lord. But previously in those psukim, we get a little bit about God's promise to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And the Midrash says the word therefore always indicates a vow. As it says, therefore I swear concerning the house of Eli. Rabbi Barachia said, by your arm you redeemed your people with grievance. Okay, let's take a moment here. We've digested a lot of content. Let's make sure that we're actually absorbing all of it. First of all, what's happening with this link from God appearing to Moshe and saying, therefore, I will take you out and the house of Eli? Okay, so a little bit about the context of that verse. That's a place where God is actually doing the opposite. God is appearing to Eli, who seems to be the Kohen Gadol in Shiloh, and saying, yes, Ariel Ahiman, exactly. His sons are problematic. His sons have been committing all these sins, and Eli hasn't reproved them. And God is actually appearing to Eli and saying, that's it. My covenant with your family is broken because you have sinned. Your family will be cut off, and you are no longer going to be in this position of service to me. And there, God is actually swearing that he will no longer fulfill his covenant with that house. The Midrash is doing something very clever here by linking to that and saying, implicitly, that might have been what should have happened to the Jewish people. It is possible that actually what should have happened to the Jewish people is God should have looked at them and said, nope, this is over. You haven't fulfilled what I told you to do. But instead, when it comes to the Jewish people as a whole, God is bound by God's covenant. such that God is actually imprisoned by it. There is no opportunity for God to renege on God's covenant with the Jewish people, in contrast to the house of Eli. Rabbi Brachia said, by your arm you redeemed your people, Bizrah, and he translates that as actually with grievance. You did it under duress. You didn't necessarily want to redeem them, but you had to. Okay. Rabbi Yudan said, from venture to go and take for himself one nation from the midst of another to prodigious acts by signs and portents. Yeah, this is in Devarim Dalet, is 72 letters. 72 letters, as we'll see, is supposed to be the number of letters in a specific name of God. If someone tells you that it's 75 letters, tell them that the second incidence of Goy is not included in the count. 75 minus the three letters in Goy gets you 72. Rabbi Avin said, God redeemed the Jewish people through his own name, as the name of God is 72 letters. We're going to pause here. Who was it in the chat who said God redeemed the Jewish people for the sake of his name, for the sake of God's name? Whoever it was, you intuited Rabbi Avin's answer in many ways. You actually were tapping into this idea of God actually didn't redeem the Jewish people for the Jewish people. God redeemed the Jewish people because in some way God needed to do it for God's glory, or God needed to do it because God was bound by a promise that God made. God was bound by what it means to be God. Let's pause here. I'm reading back in the chat when I asked, how are you feeling at this point in the Midrash? Robert Niederman said, it's a little alienating but comfort because it doesn't seem like we are that different from other people. That's really interesting, meaning at the end of the day, we're human beings. It's not holding us to this different standard. And actually, it's the Midrash stepping in and saying, being human does not make you stop being God's beloved people. Let's take a little bit to get some other emotional responses for people. If we imagine this is being delivered as a sermon in Shul, what spiritual need, what emotional need is this serving? Alicia Maxwell says, it reminds me of, I didn't choose you because you were stronger or better than other nations. In fact, you were the smallest. Yes, which is in some ways possibly a reproof. Don't think that well of yourself, but also maybe in some ways a little bit comforting. We don't have to be the best. That is not why God chose us. Melinda says, comforting, God's promise to our ancestors is still in effect, as we tell God all the time in the Amida and Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, so we still have the opportunity to be redeemed. Great. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. Let's look at the context for the Pasuk from Devarim Dalet. This is the context for the Pasuk from Devarim Dalet where we're actually counting the letters. And I'm just going to read this out loud. The Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and only a scant few of you shall be left among the nations to which the Lord will drive you. There you will serve man-made gods of wood and stone, and I'm skipping ahead. But if you search for the Lord your God, you will find him, if only you seek him with all your heart and your soul. And let's skip ahead to the end, just to make sure that we see the connection to our psukim. 33. Has any people heard the voice of God speaking out of the fire as you have and survived? Or has any God ventured to go to take for himself one nation from the midst of another? So let's just pay attention to what the Midrash is doing by bringing these particular verses from Devarim. The Midrash is actually linking us to a moment where the Torah promises us there will be a point where you'll be exiled and you will give in to everything that I have forbidden you. You will worship idols. You will not follow my Torah. You will not follow my commandments. But if you cry out, I will redeem you, and I can promise you that I will redeem you because I have done this before. And in the Midrash's reading, that I have done this before is actually at a time where you were doing the exact same thing. You were indistinguishable from the people you were among. You were not following my commandments, and yet I redeemed you because I am bound by my promises. This seems to actually be, some people have an allergic reaction to this word, but it actually seems to be a particularly Jewish idea of the concept of grace. God redeems you not because of your merit, but because of what God is bound to do. Let's take a moment and we'll go ahead to the second midrash. And I want us to have in our heads thinking about in what ways is this second midrash comforting in a different way? And which do you personally find more comforting? And which do you personally find more meaningful? Rabbi Azariah said in the name of Rabbi Yehuda, in the name of Rabbi Simon, this matter can be compared to a king who had an orchard planted with figs and grapes and pomegranates and apples, and left the orchard in the care of a sharecropper. So here we're taking the image of the rose among the thorns more literally. Where is this rose popping up? Originally, there was an orchard. And the Midrash seems to be playing with the words of the verses surrounding the verse about the rose among the thorns, which include comparing the male beloved to an apple tree in the forest. So we have this image of the king's orchard. He lives it in the care of a sharecropper. After many days, the king returned and peeked into the orchard to find out what the sharecropper had done with it. He found the orchard full of thorns and nettles. The king brought instruments to cut down the orchard, but then spotted a single rose among the thorns. He took the rose and smelled its fragrance, and it calmed his soul. The king said, "Because of this rose, the entire orchard will be saved." So just the image, this time is very different. It's not that it's difficult to find the rose among the thorns. It's that actually the rose among the thorns is very noticeable, and it saves the rest of the orchard. It saves the thorns. It saves everything that is irredeemable around it. So too, the world was only created for Torah. After 26 generations, God peeked into the world to see what had become of it and found it flooded with water. And here water seems to be a stand-in for sin, for chaos. The generation of Enosh flooded with waters. The generation of the flood flooded with waters. The generation of the Tower of Babel flooded with waters. And he brought instruments to destroy it. As it says, the Lord sat enthroned at the flood. God saw a single rose, that is Israel, the Jewish people, and took it and smelled it. And in that moment that he gave them the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments. So when did God smell the single rose? It was at Sinai. And his soul was calmed at the moment he said, "Na'aseh v'nishma," we will do and we will listen. God said, "Because of this orchard, because of this rose, the orchard will be saved. In the merit of Israel and the Torah, the entire world will be saved." So let's take a moment here. We have two very different descriptions of what the Jewish people's role is in the world and what the Jewish people's relationship with God is. In the first one, we're actually surrounded by thorns to the point that we're almost indistinguishable from the thorns. And we're not redeemed because it's easy for God. We're not redeemed because it's attractive for God. We're redeemed because God has made this promise. God is bound to redeem us. And that promise stands up against all time and anything that we can do. And in the other midrash, we have this image of the rose among the thorns. The entire world has grown full of thorns and nettles. And God actually finds solace because of the Jewish people and the Torah. And in that midrash, in that image, it is actually the rose that saves the orchard. It is the Jewish people that somehow allows the world to continue. Let's take a moment and get some reactions on the chat. What emotional need is this second midrash? Is this second midrash fulfilling? How do you assimilate that on an emotional, pastoral, spiritual lens? And which of these midrashim actually appeals to you more? Which of these midrashim do you find more comforting? In the Midrash, I'm just going to read a question. In the Midrash, who is the sharecropper? Are we the sharecropper? That is, who is shirked their responsibility in the world? That's a great question. It seems that the sharecropper disappears unless it's referring to humanity as a whole, which is difficult because it seems that humanity are the plants. So I think that that kind of disappears in the explanation of the parable. Let's just read some of the answers in the chat. Ellen Rothberg, fascinating. We're hearing the water is chaos, but it has traditionally been understood as Torah. Great. This actually seems to be going back to a much earlier vision of what water symbolizes, where water symbolizes forces of chaos that appear in Tehillim, sometimes in Bereishit. Paul and Leah Jenner said, the world is saved because of us, rather egocentric of us. Yeah, this is a midrash that is fully, the second midrash is fully bought in to Jewish exceptionality, such that the entire view of the world is centered around the Jewish people. Arlene Berger says, back to the non-anthropomorphic God. God needed a people, friends, playmates to be loved. Yeah, I, for all that I don't know that I immediately relate to the explanation of the parable in the second Midrash, the image of a God who is distressed and takes in the scent of the rose and is calmed is absolutely beautiful. God needs something to be calm. God needs this scent, actually, which is a very Noach type image. Robert Niederman, I find it inspiring that I am asked to be a rose among the thorns, which gives me a purpose for living a life worth living. That's beautiful. Thank you. Alicia Maxwell says, the second one might be more helpful in times of persecution, establishing that our people still have value even when the world hates us. But I like the first one better because it doesn't so easily lead to pride and we are better than other peoples. And it reassures us in times that when we might have a negative outlook on what our people are doing or not doing in the world. Yes, that very much resonates. And I also really appreciate how you are being very sensitive to needs and how they're different at different time periods. Let's just read a few more of these and then close up. Joe Schwartz, to everyone, I second Robert's comment. It would inspire me to be the best person I can be. Yeah, I'm thinking more about this. And the first one actually does implicitly allow a slipping that the second one doesn't. If you are convinced that actually the world might be destroyed or God needs this solace in the world, there's a motivation to be God's solace in the world in a way that is very affirming. Shoshana Ben David, I find the first Midrash more comforting because it gives more power to God himself. Elizabeth Ehrlich, Sermon 1, distinguish yourself so God will recognize you and save you. Sermon 2, your difference recognized by God is beautiful and saves the world. That's beautiful. Thank you. Melinda Zalman, in the second Midrash, God is not comforted until Na'aseh v'Nishmah, so we need to commit in order to be redeemed. In the first Midrash, we only need to call out. That's very interesting. That's very interesting. We actually do not have to do anything except for build a connection to God simply through our instinctive crying. Ariella Hyman, after reading the second Midrash, I feel like I connect more with the first. It doesn't matter what I do or don't accomplish. It gives room to believe that God loves us regardless of our actions. Yeah, there's an unconditional promise here that is very different than someone mentioned above, that the very popular Midrash that we didn't change and that's why we were redeemed. Here it's, no matter how much you change, I will still be able to recognize you. Rachel Lieberman, I like the promise of the first, very comforting, and knowing that we can live amongst all the others, and also like the sense of acknowledgement of the second, appreciating for your own uniqueness and possibility of transforming. And last one for now, Melinda Zalma, they seem to work together as a second Midrash, we're already out of Egypt. Interesting, so you can actually read this as a continuation. What was the impetus? It's found in the first Midrash. Two steps of tshuva, first call out, then commit to change. And I know I said last one, but this is something that has to be read out loud. If God is our parent, God loves us unconditionally. Okay, we're going to close up here. What I want to leave us with today is these two separate images of what it means to be in relationship with God. The first image promises us a sort of grace simply by virtue of God's promise. God has made a promise. God has entered into relationship with us. And that actually is not something that God will change God's mind about, even if God wants to. And part of what I love about this is that this is giving room for a relationship where God might actually want to walk away at some times. And I think that we have all felt this in many of our relationships in life at some point where we're absolutely committed. There are moments where we feel great anger. There are moments where we feel, I don't know how I can keep doing this. Hopefully they're few and far between. But what keeps us is actually a commitment that we've made. And it is the commitment to listening when the other person cries out and loving them despite anything else that might happen. The second image is a promise that God actually takes comfort in us. And that's a very different sort of relationship image. That's an image that promises, even when you feel like the world is full of thorns, even when you feel like it's full of nettles, God looks at you and God finds you beautiful. And you actually are something that God needs. I love the idea that someone threw out that these two work together. And I think that that's very true to relationships in life as well. Those two have to work together for a relationship to thrive. And I'm really glad that I got to learn with all of you this morning. We're going to close up here for the sake of time. Thank you so much, everyone. Looking forward to seeing you on